Hey Ding Dongs, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie, the political comedy podcast in which I, Jamie, a politically innocent but curious young man, have the complicated political happenings of the world explained to him in real time by his friend Richard Lamb.
That's me!
Yahoo! How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing pretty good, man. Still in New York City. It's hot as absolute hell here, but it's pretty cool town, you know?
Yeah, I like that you're down in New York because I feel like it gives our podcast some real fucking cred. You know, the fact that we got one person in Toronto, one person in New York. How cool is that?
That's right, man. I'm in the cradle of so many important political ideas. I'm in the place where Alexander Hamilton wrote all his raps. Like, you know, I feel his ghost whispering in my ear everywhere I go. Or maybe it's my schizophrenia. Yeah. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, well,
you know, the doctors can call it what they want.
I'm really excited for this episode for a couple of reasons. One, it's been, like, heavily requested. Yes. And also, it's something I don't know much about, and I myself have been yearning to be explained to me, you know? It's more than just homework. This is going to be great.
Yeah, for those of you who just mashed play on this podcast without reading what the title of the episode is, we're going to be talking today about Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission report.
Yeah.
And we've also mentioned it a bunch of times on the show because it's the kind of thing that, like, once you start talking about anything to do with Canadian history, you almost inevitably find your way to it at some point because it just dominates the entire past of our country. Once you kind of go, it's real, like, through the looking glass kind of experience to put your head against it for the first time, because once you go through it and start to understand what's contained in it, it's sort of impossible to undo that, to unlearn the information that you learn, and you sort of see everything differently. At least this was my experience of reading it.
Yeah, as we've sort of been discovering, it seems to be like the pass go of the whole Aboriginal conversation. Is that it always comes up and it's always referenced?
We'll talk about why that is. We'll definitely talk about why that is. I mean, it's definitely not the be-all and end-all of the conversation, but it is, like, a useful reference point for a number of reasons. We'll talk about it. But first, we should probably welcome our guests who are with us patiently waiting in the corner of this Google Hangout.
That's right. Please welcome back, and now officially the most constant guest on our podcast.
Yep, you got
Hunter
the gold medal
Cardinal
for guests.
Yeah. He has just surpassed Stephanie Baptist. This is his third time appearing on the podcast, as well as first timer, his sister, Jackie Cardinal.
Welcome, guys.
Yeah. Welcome. How are you guys doing?
You
guys
are, and identify yourselves vocally.
Yeah. Okay. So we're recording live from Edmonton, Alberta.
Represent.
Yeah. So, Jack, do you want to do a nice intro on yourself and all the amazing things you've been doing?
Oh, God. Okay. Well, my name is Jackie, as we all made sure to understand before we started recording.
Yeah.
And I am a techie. Me and my brother, we both work at a company called Nahayoan that we started about a year ago.
Mm.
And we're just doing stuff with communications and media and that kind of thing. And I'm really excited to be talking about the TRC today because I actually met Justice Murray Sinclair and Wilton Littlechild not that long ago. So,
Didn't you also just appear before the Senate?
Yeah.
And, like, talk to the Senate about how to just get their shit together?
Basically.
It was an interesting opportunity because what Jackie and I have been doing with our work with Nahayoan is we're trying to answer the question of, okay, so how do we apply Indigenous governance principles, our values, our guiding thoughts, and put them into our modular and dynamic systems like tech, community engagement, and what does that mean? So we're kind of playing a little bit more with, like, a vitality to indigeneity that has always existed since time immemorial. So what Jackie got asked to do, she got, like, nominated and, like, accepted as, like, a very small number of Indigenous entrepreneurs to go to the Senate, and
not even just entrepreneurs too.
Just like
it was a couple thousand people were nominated, and I was one of nine.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
I know, but I mean, and the thing is that like all this work that we're talking about, I mean, when you go to Ottawa, like the TRC is so embedded in every conversation that you have. So again, really, a really pertinent conversation to be having at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, excited is a strange word to use, but I am kind of excited to use like whatever platform we have to talk about it, because it has come to really dominate my own mental space too when I think about almost every issue in our country. And I'm really excited to share it with Jamie, share it with the listeners, and to, you know, throw multiple perspectives on this thing and really dig into it and share this information. So why don't we leave a very convenient gap for our theme song right about here.
Wah, wah, wah. Here we are, back to the theme song and getting into the topic.
All right.
Yay!
So, Jamie, what do you know? This is how we usually start. What do you know about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report?
Honestly, very, very little. From rumblings from my friend group, I understand it's kind of an inept at what it's supposed to do. I associate it myself with like residential schools and that whole history, but I know very little about the specifics of what it is and what it's meant to do. So this is going to be, you guys are starting from zero pretty well here. Yeah, that's what I know.
Okay, cool. All right, I mean, you're not wrong. Like, those are all factual and correct things. And guys, feel free to please interrupt me and jump in here with, you know, corrections on my sort of spotty knowledge of the logistics of the report. To the best of my knowledge, it was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report was put together. It started being put together about 10 years ago. Is that right? Like, about the mid-2000s. It was kind of when the first snowball started rolling on it, and it was essentially like a massive fact-finding mission to create a comprehensive understanding of what happened in the residential schools in Canada. In essentially, I mean, the scope of it is like essentially from before Canada was even a country, like in the early 19th century, all the way until the late 90s when the last residential school finally closed, right? And it was an attempt to just truly quantify and bring into the light the many, many abuses and injustices, and essentially just the reality of what happened in those schools to generations and generations of Indigenous people who were taken away from their homes and forced to kind of like live in these boarding schools. And it was a way to just quantify their experience. It was a way for the government to finally kind of like acknowledge and hear and legitimize their experiences. And it kind of created a central collection point of all of their, of what happened, of all the information and all of the background and history and individual people's stories, to kind of collect it all in one place and recommend how to possibly move forward from the things that happened in the past. Now, already I'm making it sound like the government was like cooperative. They weren't. It was like a super hostile and like incredibly labored and difficult process that the commissioners went through in order to collect this information. They had to like multiple times sue the government for essentially to give them information that was in some basement in Ottawa about who, you know, how many people were taken, statistics, all kinds of things the government didn't want to see the light of day. And it was the work of almost an entire decade, I think, to finally publish this report, which was published in 2014, I believe. The actual report is like 3,000 pages long. Most people, when they're talking about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, are talking about the summary of the report, which is like 200 pages long. And they're, it's a pretty devastating an intense hit. Like it's an incredibly readable document in a way, in that it's like it's written very well. It's very clear. It's well laid out, and it essentially moves from the history of all of Canadian settlement. Like like in tracing the lines of the. Of what happened in the residential school, it has to go. You have to kind of go all the way back to like the moment the first settler arrives from Europe in Canada, in what this, you know, North America, what we call Canada, and understand like why they made the decisions that they made, and their whole worldview, and then kind of extrapolate that forward into why the residential schools even happened, why they happened the way that they happened, and then why the abuses that happened inside them happened. And then why we have the world we have today because of all of those things interlinked through history. So it's a really, really, it's like kind of like an alternative history of Canada in a way. The kind that you don't really learn in textbooks except in like a weird sidebar. Anyway, that's my like basic bitch settler summary. Why don't you guys say a thing or two about what you think it is?
Yeah. So, I mean, like one thing that I usually like to return to when you're talking about the TRC is, you know, where did it actually come from? Where right. did this report and this commission, where did they actually get their start? And as I understand it, the commission actually came from a bunch of survivors of the residential school system that won their settlements in court and basically mm-hmm. took their money from their win and said, how can we actually not only make sure that, you know, that we can learn more about our experience and contextualize it, but how can we also make sure that, you know, more Canadians know about what happened? And really kind of make a good play at it. So they approached essentially the Truth and Reconciliation Commission kind of structure that they used in South Africa right. and basically put that into play. So that's something that I like to return to, so that really, you know, when I think about the TRC, when I read the document, I always think about the people that made such a sacrifice to actually give the money that they won in their settlement to move forward this conversation.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's worth bringing up right now early that like the term Truth and Reconciliation, I found this really helpful. In the report, they describe it as like a spectrum. It's like a process with truth at one end, like at the start of the process, and reconciliation at some very far other point in the process, much later down the road. The idea being like, first, everyone has to get on the same page about what happened. First, we just all have to agree on a collective set of information about what happened in the past. And I think this is a really important element of the TRC report, because I think it's still a missing element in Canadian society, and it's why the report is so necessary to talk about, is that like there will never be justice until everyone can agree on the facts. And as we kind of alluded to in our Canada Day episode, it's easy for people to get kind of bogged down in like anecdotes and personal prejudices and their own personal lived experiences, but to not understand like the entire scope of history, you know, and the actual quantifiable things that happened. And that's kind of like essential to understand what happened. We have to create that record, and that's kind of what this was the first step in doing.
Yeah, so let me just throw a big old pause on this for a second. So just so I'm clear, so the impulse to create this thing was set effectively a standard set of information for this is what happened, these are the facts, because once we have the facts, then we can move forward and decide what we want to do with them. Who came up with the idea? It was people who were part of the residential schools.
Yeah, survivors of the residential
schools. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it's really important too to just like highlight that this commission too is primarily focusing on the Indian residential school system itself. I think that's like critically important, because as an idea to hold up while we're talking about this is focusing primarily on the residential school system,
right?
Yeah. And that's, it is important, it is the focus of it all. It illuminates 100,000 other things to start to pull the thread of the residential school system, but it is the focus. I mean, okay, so let's, what was a residential school? Do you, like, I don't think that necessarily people even will know that. So the residential school system has existed in Canada since just before Confederation in some kind of like early state, but it really kind of came into full existence after Confederation and in like the late 19th century. Mm. And it was essentially like even the more gentle term for it that they would have used in the past is like it was an attempt to assimilate indigenous people into like Western culture and basically make them stop living their lives the way that they were living them and make them start living them like Europeans left them. Like that was the stated goal of the residential school system. They wanted to essentially like they were having all kinds of trouble making indigenous people assimilate into Western culture, mostly because indigenous people thought it was a shitty deal.
That's hard.
Like, they
to
didn't like
and
it.
Weird.
Yeah, like, they were like, "No, this is bad. I don't like." And there's, it's almost like if you know all of the horrible things hadn't happened, when you read in the report, like there's all these attempts to like make indigenous people try to be more Western, and they were always just like, "No, this sucks. I don't want to do it," and they would just leave. Right. So the solution they concocted, the Canadians of the 19th century, was to take kids away from their families while they were really, really young and forcibly separate them from being able to learn their own cultures and instead like indoctrinate them with Western culture.
It's like a more aggressive form of being like missionary.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, like,
it's like
there's
you're going instead of going to another place and saying this is the great religion from the West and this is the great way of life from the West. They took a huge chunk of land, sat down, built buildings, and said more aggressively, "This is the way things are now." Right?
Not just more aggressively, like to the point where this is a genocide. Like this is like the report uses these words, and this is one of those like hard facts that's like the kind of thing that already like people like letters to the editor that are indignant and defensive are being composed as we say this, but like this was an attempt to destroy indigenous culture. That was the goal of it. John A. MacDonald is like on the books as saying like, "Man, I hope these residential schools finally destroy indigenous culture." You know, like those are the kinds of quotes that exist.
Right.
Right. They wanted indigenous people to not have their culture anymore and it just be exactly like white European people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was what they're trying to do. And sure, maybe there weren't like gas chambers, but there was like violence, psychological abuse, sexual abuse, and like generations of trauma. And the goal at the end of the day was kind of the same thing. They wanted these cultures eradicated. Mm. They wanted them to be invisible and they wanted to take all the land. They didn't want to have any obligations to the indigenous people anymore that would interfere with expansion and economic development and all
because
that.
Because what was happening at this time too was a lot of the treaties that were starting to be made in response to the, discovery of natural resources at the time when also North America was being like, "Oh my gosh, you guys, this oil stuff is great for a select few amount of people." Was starting, those treaties, the number treaties, like 6, 7, and 8, those were being signed at this point too. So just like politically, that was the time. Also, the Indian Act was coming in. So there was a push to start dispossessing indigenous people from their lands, but more importantly, severing the primary relationship that they had with their land and their family unit and their culture too.
Yeah. Well, and you and I were talking a little bit about this a couple months ago, maybe a month ago, Hunter, and maybe, I don't know, maybe Jackie and Richard know a little something about it, but I was reading recently that, oh God, I'm so awful with names for this kind of thing. But there's a politician who, a number of politicians who are now putting it forward to Justin Trudeau, something about the Indian Act, that actually the Indian Act is actually reducing the slowly but surely the number of people who can claim First Nations status because of something to do with your mother and your father, if your father's not and your mother is, or whatever. And this politician's put it forward, you know, this is racism, this is clearly it's reducing the number of Aboriginal people. The whole point of this law is to slowly dwindle that away until they don't exist anymore. And Trudeau's government is fighting against this, because if this is actually true, the number of people who can claim First Nation status multiplies by a whole bunch, and that's a whole new can of worms for Mr. Trudeau and his government to take care of.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like as after we go through a sort of like basic historical facts of the TRC, we could probably talk a little bit about, you know, the vast actual cultural divide between like Western settler Canadian society and Indigenous society. But like, I know I follow a lot of Indigenous people on Twitter, which is something I super recommend doing actually, because it's a lot of great Indigenous discourse on Twitter, and it's a much easier way to like actually see real Indigenous people talking about their lives than other places. And one of the things that I know is that what they call blood quantum, which is that whole like, oh yeah, I'm 1/8 of this thing, yeah, is a super contentious thing even among Indigenous people, because that's like imposing a Western notion of lineage onto Indigenous systems that don't necessarily have anything to do with that, right? Like there's there's so many different Indigenous nations in Canada that don't share the same customs at all, and basically, you know, even using like the idea that you have that, like, it's like because you have an ancestor who's Indigenous means you get some kind of Indigenous status. There's many like Indigenous nations that wouldn't, that means nothing to them, and they have huge issues with being forced to quantify their own belonging that way. So like already that's easy answers,
very
to any
similar
of this.
To like the Romans and the Jews, like the Romans dictated if your mother's Jewish then you're Jewish, and now that's like a weird rule that we all accept.
Yeah, I mean, it is, I don't know enough about that particular example to be like, yes, you're right.
No,
Judaism's interesting too. Like my old school, my like Jewish history class was like, well, a long time ago now in university. But I would say it actually is kind of almost a compare and contrast situation, where like Judaism's been characterized in a lot of ways by its ability to kind of morph into whatever dominant culture that the Jewish minority is a part of. So that's why like in America, American Judaism looks very different from Russian Judaism, because it's able to just like absorb, like Jewish people, there's a diaspora, right? They had to leave their homeland and go everywhere and kind of live as minorities inside larger societies like all over the world. So they were able to kind of constantly shift their practices around wherever they were to kind of blend into the mainstream while still holding like kind of a core of Judaism. And it's kind of the opposite almost with Indigenous people. This is a really crude comparison, but like because we came here and we like enveloped them, you know, in a way we kind of pushed them into concentrations and things like that. It's not a perfect comparison, right? I would say.
So okay, so let's take it back to the TRC. So
yeah, residential schools.
Yeah.
So the government formed these residential schools to try to destroy Indigenous culture, to try to get to Indigenous children before their parents had a chance to teach them Indigenous stuff and teach them Western stuff instead. Now, all the residential schools were religious schools, right? So they like basically gave contracts out to different churches and religious branches to run these schools instead of for the government. And part of what made them so fucked up is that they were, even though they were a grotesque and horrible idea to begin with, but they were also super, super badly executed. And that did not help them, you know, they did not help them at all. Like, in the Platonic ideal of what the residential school was supposed to be in the minds of the people who conceived it. Now, I don't think, and I'm not in like endorsing this, I don't think this is like a good idea, but they had this like vision of these like self-sustaining schools where kids were like learning trades and were able to like grow crops at the school and feed themselves. And the schools would be these kind of like self-contained little like units that were like little mini villages.
You heard it here first, folks. Richard thinks this is all a good idea.
This is the
wonderful idea.
This is the 30-second clip that's going to get me put on like a list somewhere.
We're already on all the lists.
But the point is that like basically the way that they set up the residential schools, the churches got money per student. So like for every student you had at the school, you got a certain amount of money for your budget. It was never enough money. So all the residential schools could like barely afford to pay their teachers, which meant that only the shittiest people in Canada would teach at the residential schools, because it was such a shit job that it attracted people who couldn't get any other job to be these teachers. And it also meant that, like, basically the economic model encouraged these schools to just grab as many students as they possibly could to get on their books, to get the largest budget from the government that they could, right? And it was all of, like, these are many of the factors that led to there being so much physical and sexual abuse in these schools, because it was like there was so little oversight of, like, who was teaching there, what was being taught there, what the conditions there were, in theory, like minimum conditions and things like that. And especially, and as the years went on, there were like more stringent conditions placed on like what a school could be, but they were rarely followed. Often they were often covered up. There was lots of shiftiness, and they were cutting corners constantly. Every residential school was slightly different, and they depended on the character of the people who were running them at a given time. But, like, you know, a lot of the times they would give them shitty food. They would give the students not enough to eat to save money. They would force them to try to do chores all day and do all this labor and, you know, work for other people and sell their labor and keep all the money. You know, this all kind, any injustice that you can think of arising from this situation,
right,
probably happened at some point. There's like, story, you know, that somebody, it happened to somebody, and their story is collected in the TRC report.
Wow.
So, okay, this might be a real dumb question.
But, no, this is what this is for.
What, yeah. The residential school? What, that, just the title itself? Residential meaning people.
So in contrast to like the school that you go to, where you go home every day, it's like you live at the school. Right, you take school, right? But that's part of the structure of it. It's like when the students were allowed to go home to their families every day, they stayed all indigenous and they didn't become nice Western people, right? So that's why they wanted to make residential schools to take them away from their families.
What if we just took them away from their families?
Like, this was literally the actual conversation that all the people who are being celebrated in this Canada 150 thing, they had this conversation. They were all proponents of it.
Right.
Like, there was no opposition to the residential schools that I could see. It's certainly not in the mainstream. Nobody thought it was a bad idea to do this in mainstream settler culture at the time. It was not seen as like immoral or anything.
Right.
And I mean, we can talk about that whole thing too. Hunter and Jackie, I've been talking a lot. Do you guys have anything? Are you like, everything you just said is wrong? Let's spend the next 25 minutes correcting everything Richard just said.
No, yeah, I just quickly. I lost it. Jack, you want to go?
Sibling.
No, but some of the things when it's like, oh, they take them away from the family. In some cases, it was literally they would go on one side of the country and take a kid from a family and then put them on the other side of the country to really make sure that they really severed them and put them in a completely alien environment to make them completely dependent. It was horrible. And like,
yeah.
Richard, you mentioned before, like, this, like, a lot of the times this has been almost like put to the side a bit and be like, well, yeah, the residential schools is cultural genocide. And it's like, no, it actually was genocide under, you know, the convention, the Geneva Convention on Genocide in 1948. Canada actually committed crimes that would constitute what they did, i.e. the residential schools, as an act of genocide. So that's an important thing, just so that we're really just like clear of the terms that exist and the reasons why they exist and how they apply to this.
Yeah, it was like so casually barbaric. I mean, like they were gender segregated, the residential schools. Like within one school, the boys and girls were kept almost totally separate usually. So like if you, like Jamie, if you and your sister were taken to residential school, you'd be split up the first day you were there, and it's entirely possible you would never talk to each other until you were adults, and you wouldn't know each other. Mm. You'd have no family relationship to each other. You'd be strangers. And that happened to generations of Indigenous people across the country.
Right.
You know, like they destroyed families on purpose to try to stop them from having their own culture.
Now, to be fair, they were trying to build a railroad, guys.
Yeah. I mean, like, it is like a joke, but it's It's 100% true. That's what they're trying to do.
I know. I'm just trying to inject levity.
Trying to land the mood. I have horrible news about all the other stuff we have to talk about.
Okay, so that's what the residential schools were. Truth and Reconciliation Commission as I understand, was meant to identify the truth, to identify the facts, so that reconciliation can come down the pipe. Now, as far as I know, I mean, I understand we live in this crazy world in which, depending on your political party, up may mean a different thing than up to you, and down may mean a different thing to down, in this world of fake news and alternative facts. But, like, if the truth is the truth, facts are facts, what's the issue? Wherein lies the issue with this commission?
I do feel like
I just played hopscotch.
I want Hunter and Jackie to weigh in on what they think of this, but like, as a settler, what I see is that a lot of people just haven't absorbed it yet. And one of the things that the TRC report does really well is it's like, why did they do this? What, like, was it because the residential schools didn't just exist because they wanted to build a railroad. I mean, yes, they did just exist because they wanted to build a railroad. The economics are very important. They wanted the resources, they wanted the land. But also, and this is one of the real things that are gonna, like, that mess with my head as a settler reading this, indigenous culture was just believed to be inferior because of white supremacy, and that's why we have this country. This country exists because the white people who made it believed themselves to be better because of their race. And every single institution and thing that we have in this country is based in white supremacy. It's in our foundation.
Yeah, okay. I think you've misread my question. What's the problem with residential schools?
I mean, like, the problem is that people are slow to get that. Like, people don't want to admit that. And it's in not wanting to realize almost everything your country did was in service of horrible things. And that our country was never nice, and it was never kind, and we were never the reasonable ones. That's all just bullshit. We were horrible racists committing a genocide for 150 years. Like, people don't want to admit that, and that's why the truth has been very, very slow to percolate out. It's because it's really traumatic. You have to engage in kind of a traumatic destruction of your own narrative of what Canada's been in a way that it is painful, and it's shitty, and it's emotional, and it certainly doesn't compare to, like, the abuse that those people went through, but it's also still real. You have to kind of divest of the Canada that you think you know, and that's not going to happen overnight for a lot of people. That's something I see.
For sure. And I guess I want to re-aim my question at the TRC. And I'm maybe coming off primed to I feel like I'm priming myself not to accept the TRC as working as it should or as it was intended. So if this is the truth and we're aiming at reconciliation and that's where we're going towards, what are the shortcomings of it? What, you know? Am I being clear? I don't know.
I think what you're getting at is kind of the part of the TRC that a lot of people are probably most aware of, which are the calls to action. So, you know, after they report about, you know, the entire history, they kind of, you know, sum up kind of what happened, what they heard, and, you know, thousands and thousands of stories that they heard. How do you then say, okay, government, these are all the things that you should do to try and fix it. Here are the steps towards reconciliation. So I think that it's a tough thing to start to talk about, because then we have to really start about, okay, well, then what's the goal? What is reconciliation? Is reconciliation just another way to say, like, okay, well, we did something bad and we all, you know, are very sorry and now let's continue? And it's almost a means for another way to start colonizing again, because, well, we already talked about that, so let's all move on. I think that's part of the conversation. And I also think as well, if you look at a lot of the calls to action, as Hunter and I are both in technically the corporate sectors, we own a company, a lot of the calls to action are aimed pretty much only at the nation state, not really at individuals. So I think despite the fact that a lot of people are aware of the TRC, there isn't really a way that the TRC really places a lot of the power for reconciliation in the hands of everyday Canadians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think to expand off that is this is very exciting for us, because this is what Jackie and I talk about on our walks to work. But when we're talking about moving forward and putting the past behind us, it kind of once again gently reaffirms and reestablishes a very Western idea of like linear progress, and it kind of lets people off the hook because, you know, we can't really fix it and like, you know, what are we going to do? Like, it kind of makes reconciliation just like a, yeah, you know, I think I was trying to think of a good metaphor for it, but if it's like you're like smothering someone and you're like face to face with them, and you say to the person that you're smothering, like, I'm so sorry. We really need to look at what happened, how we got into this mess. Let's move forward. And then you just don't get up off of that person. Like, you could totally write a commission about it. And that, and like, especially if that person's like, hey, we should probably talk about the fact that you're smothering me. You know, that's great. That's an important conversation to happen. But we have to be really careful that when we talk about moving forward, we define what forward is. Is it continuing in a really unstable Western, like neoliberal model where we're all happy consumers just doing our best? Eventually, we're going to get to Star Trek and we'll be in the stars, just continually growing this like system that we have? Or is it something different? So a lot of the discussion that's happening in the scholarship right now is talking about this idea of restitution before reconciliation, where you actually restore what's been damaged to the original state before you can talk about what happened and why. So that's one of the major drawbacks that I see. And it's not so much that the TRC is a bad thing and we shouldn't be talking about it and we should blah, blah, blah. That is an important conversation to have. And unlike a very like Western linear way of what's the one right way, there is room for other discussions to be had and other forms of action that we can do as a nation, right, as treaty people, as our obligations originally intended us to be able to fulfill as friends.
Right, right. Yeah.
I mean, like, I had kind of like a sad shower moment myself. Like, man, when I was after, in like a month after
every
the TRC.
Day.
Yeah. But where I was like, I remember kind of connecting a dot in my brain and going, oh, reconciliation will never happen under capitalism. It's because the capitalist values of growth and profit are themselves kind of like the fundamental conflict between what were indigenous cultures. And in order for reconciliation to happen, capitalism will have to like recognize values that are not growth and profit. And if that ever happens, capitalism will have been fundamentally changed into something different. If capitalism ever like gives up the throne to something and acknowledges the legitimacy of a different way of living, it will no longer be capitalism as we know it, certainly. Or will have forced reconciliation on a population of indigenous people inside the capitalism we have. And in that case, the cultural genocide's just done, right? At that point, like, that's those people, that culture has been eradicated, right? And John A. MacDonald and the rest of the white dudes who started Canada, their project is complete. Their genocide's finished. It's like those are kind of like two different visions of how it could go. But I, you know, part of the larger conversation that we have a lot on this podcast about how capitalist values are kind of reaching a serious breaking point and more people are extremely dissatisfied with them. I think reconciliation is a huge piece of that puzzle for Canada, especially. And reconciliation is one of the problems that capitalism will not solve. The market is not going to solve reconciliation.
Right. Okay. So I completely understand and agree that capitalism is kind of, obviously its sincerity is not its strong suit and it has no real incentive to be sincere capitalism and neoliberalism is a self-centered exercise. I wonder, is it possible to reconcile I think of Germany. I think of Germany and their the way they've treated the Holocaust and the way they've made it a primary goal to educate and to move forward and to grow. I don't know. Ah, fuck me. I don't know.
Basically, it's weird to talk about this in the abstract. Like, these are a ton of damage and pain was inflicted upon people who lived in the territory of Canada for no other reason than that they had a certain way they wanted to live their lives, and the government disagreed with that. And because of that, like I said, generations and generations of people were raped, beaten, their families were destroyed, and racism was deeply ingrained into Canadian society because of that. It was ingrained into the heads of the Indigenous people who went through the residential school systems because they were constantly being told their culture was of the devil and bad and inferior and needed to be beaten out of them. And, you know, even if you resist that, that's the message you're hearing as a kid for your entire life, and then that's the message your father and your grandfather and, you know, generations before that heard. And it also, you know, it poisoned the minds of the settlers too, right? Who were told, who we all come from a world where our forefathers, regardless of how much each individual person bought into the idea that Aboriginal people are inferior and Indigenous cultures were inferior, that's still the world they lived in. The government believed that and paid for schools to destroy those cultures because they were believed to be inferior. And on some level, that's absorbed into the very foundations of our society. And it's that we have to start pulling those weeds up, but they go very deep. And so we're at the very, 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 very beginning of this process of self-examination. I mean, that's what I mean, is we're not even at the point where we're doing reconciliation yet. You know, we're not even at the point where we're healing anything. We're still pointing out to people just how deep this, very black and toxic and racist line of thought goes in our society. That's what
I've from what you've just said, I've been able to take all the words that just fell out of my face and rearrange them in my brain in a way that maybe makes sense. So I'm reading this. I'm reading the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. I know I'm 12 years late to the party on that, but you know, in the book he's talking about these tests that people take to sort of work out your subconscious bias. There's these tests for gender, then for sexuality, for race, so on and so forth, and you associate words, you associate white and good, black and bad, and then you give a bunch of words and you just throw the words into a pile, and then you switch the words around, and the difference in your timing of association can imply your bias, and they can tell you have a moderate bias towards white people, a major bias towards black people, whatever it is. And but the way they find to manipulate this bias, and it doesn't matter what race you are, you know, they find black people living in certain societies have a bias against black people. There's the white people against white people, so on and so forth. Primarily, it's the majority group that most people have a bias in favor of. But you can manipulate that bias by regular education and regular immersion into people of a different culture, of different, an example. If you see more examples of great black men, or great black people, you can manipulate your bias slowly but surely. Effectively, you're just, getting used to people who are different than you, and getting used to being around cultures that are different than the one you're used to, so your bias is slowly shifting. Now, this for me, I read that and thought, well, here it is. That's the solution. The solution is that, we need to be taught more regularly in our schools, in our families, everywhere you go, you need to be dipped more regularly into a wider variety of people and points of view and ways of looking at the world, so that when you get put in the room with something that's different than you, it's not so scary. And so I wonder, I guess the thing is if entire societal change is the answer, if it is the answer, then I'm all for it. And I say gung-ho, let's fucking do it. But if it's possible is it possible to reconcile through education and through, compassion and that is, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting to kind of think about too is the fact that you can't, like, Alfred Tayake actually in an interview with Jodie Stonehouse, he said that when asked if he has hope about where we're kind of going as, you know, settlers and indigenous people, he said that, you know, well, he said, like, you know, the truth of the matter is that, you know, indigenous people could essentially be, and our cultures could essentially be eradicated within the next couple generations. Like, it's a real possibility. And that's, I guess, my sad shower thought. And it's something that I think about a lot because it's like, you know, I do think that actually we will be completely eradicated if institutions and if the culture, the dominant culture, doesn't change. And that's right. Just a reality. Right. They can't both exist. Because the fact of the matter is we are still being, and I think Hunter touched on this, is that we are still being colonized actively right now. There are more children in foster care that are of indigenous heritage than there ever were in residential schools. Like, it's still happening, and I think that's part of the danger of the TRC is that it historicizes the actual ongoing colonization that's actually happening, and it makes it seem like, oh, this is something that our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents did, as opposed to something that, you know, happens to, like, Hunter and I every day, that we have to continually battle against every day, and that our, you know, for us, like, our grandparents went to residential schools, like, it wasn't that long ago, and my dad missed going to residential school by a year, I think, just the school near where he lived closed a year before he was supposed to go, so I think that's potentially a bit of the problem there.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's definitely going to take compassion and individual education, but that's a first step. And, like, I mean, one of my other, like, this is like a pretty hot take that I don't see a lot of settlers really saying, but, like, if you just think about it for long enough, you get there. Like, Canada, if Canada ever becomes truly serious about reconciliation, Canada will have to surrender territory. Like, the borders of Canada will have to change. We have to give up land and, like, give it back to indigenous people to become nations again. And, like, you will need a passport to go there. Like, I think that is, like, a vision of justice in the future that could happen. Like, Canada's borders will shrink. Canada will lose land and not look the same as it does now. And I think if we start getting to that point, we'll know we're getting somewhere. But, like, this is a big change. This will have to be a big change. And we cannot pretend that we can get to anything like reconciliation or anything even like a basic level of justice and decency in the country that looks like the country we have now. Like, right. It will require quite a bit of change and quite a bit of undoing.
Reconciliation is certainly not going to look like an extra module in our social 10 class. Like, that's definitely not what it's going to look like. And just to add on to what you were saying, Richard, like, I think that, you know, from where Hunter and I are standing, you know, would it be great to have, like, a whole plot of land and have it our own country and just be, you know, for the Wood Cree? Like, it'd be interesting. But actually, we really love the idea, and this is where most of our work is coming from, in really imagining and carrying on the vision of the treaties. Because the treaties were always meant to be a way to share the land. And so that's something that we're interested in. Like, and I know that, at least for us, we're not interested in taking back whole plots of land. I think there are unceded territories where they would love to have their land back.
Well, and this is part of what's, I mean, already we're into, like, how fucking dumb the mainstream discourse is. It's like, really, it's like 60 different countries we're talking about, right? And you guys are from one country, and, like, I'm sure, like, you know, this is me just glibly speaking for them, but, like, I'm sure the people in Oka would love to never have to worry about their land again. You know what I mean? Like, they're already, like, developing Oka again. Like, that's been in the news this week, and I'm sure if they just had, like, a border and they were like, please don't come here anymore. Like, we really don't want to have to do this every 25 years. You know, that would be something they'd be happy about. But yeah, part of what makes it tricky too, and I think tricky and interesting and a hopeful and an inspiring way, is that Indigenous people are not a monolith in Canada, and they are many, many different
countries, basically. They're like very different groups of people with different cultures, and that like recognizing and acknowledging that indigenous people from one part, from one nation, are not the same as indigenous people from another nation is part, that's part of the learning that we all have to do too. Because I think, you know, our certainly mainstream Canadian society before us love to just shove everyone into one big lump and not worry about it too much, and that's a thing that we kind of inherited that we're, that all of us have a responsibility to undo. And it's like, it's weird when you confront the like racist just like things that are murky and floating around in your brain because you saw too many old movies when you were a kid and you have weird ideas about what indigenous people are as your like first flash images of it. Like that's something we all confront with different prejudices and race groups and stuff, but definitely it's the kind of thing we confront here. And I do hope that moving forward we find that kind of plurality, you know, like that we find ways for all of those different potentials to be expressed if they need to be expressed.
Right.
And I think
there's no way that Canada isn't going to be way more awesome when we have such rich cultures becoming, you know, able to actually engage with everybody else and make different, you know, choices and bring new songs and new ideas to Canada. And yeah, so I mean, I think that's what's really funny too. It's like with Standing Rock, when we were there, like everybody there knew that we were fighting for the water, not just for the Standing Rock Sioux, but for literally everyone downstream. And I think that that's, mm-hmm. that's what we need to remember too, is that like, you know, Indigenous Canadians aren't just fighting for ourselves. We're fighting for everyone. We're fighting for all Canadians, because really what we want are strong families and, you know, safe water and a world that we can hand on to our grandchildren that's still safe and alive.
Yeah.
Right. Right. This is very, very interesting. And I understand that point of view. Well, no, that's the wrong word. That point of view is very interesting to me because from what Richard said earlier of the idea of, if Canada is serious about reconciliation, actually dividing up chunks of land and honoring old agreements on that, I go, sure, that's, you know, fine, great, but what is the realistic, is that going to happen? And I don't know. I imagine that would just be a political fuckstorm that would like,
of course,
know,
it would be.
You know, yeah, it'd be nuts. And I just can't imagine that everyone coming to that agreement.
But that's the K-punk thing, right? Like, yeah. You can't imagine a world different than the one you live in. But this country, the borders of our country have only existed since, like, I mean, none of it was drawn in like in our lifetimes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like that border changed in our lifetimes. You know, in 1787, France was a monarchy, and then 4 years later, those people were all headless, right? Like, huge changes do happen in societies, but for some reason, we're in this like weird political moment where we've been kind of like drained of our political will by late capitalism, and we just can't conceive of anything ever changing anymore.
Right, right.
And that's one of the symptoms of the neoliberal thing that we're in right now, that, you know, we all got to kind of swim upstream of that and dare to dream of like big ideas and big projects. And because I think that the fatigue that you feel when you're like, oh, it's so much work,
is
like a real tool of the status quo, right? But like, yeah, it is a lot of work, but it's the only way forward. I mean, it's that, or we all contribute to just, we become contributors to this injustice by doing nothing. Just like we've kind of been talking about on the last couple episodes, this idea has come up. And this is another one of those things. If you do nothing, you are actively aiding a status quo that is unjust and colonizing and racist.
Well, as our listeners are becoming very well acquainted with, I'm not like, I feel pretty unequipped to do talk about a lot of political things. This topic in particular, I'm finding myself really, like, this conversation is really igniting and interesting and exciting for me. I find it exhausting in a good way, in a way that I'm aware of how badly I want to be able to talk about this thing and how inept I feel at talking about this thing. You know what I mean? Like how, and that's, I don't know, exciting for me. And yeah, it makes me aware of how fucking hard and deep this shit is. Man, how hard and deep it is, man.
I really recommend reading the report. I mean, it is, you know, this is, the podcast exists so that in theory, so people don't have to do that kind of thing, but I don't think it's avoidable always in this. If you really do are curious about this kind of thing and want to know more about it, I'm talking also to, you know, the people listening. It's about 200 pages. It's well written.
Yeah.
It's worth reading. And it really is a great resource. Yeah.
And as well, I think it would be really good to look at the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as well. It's an even shorter read, and if you get a little bit fatigued by the TRC and even just the calls to action, the UNDRIP, what people call it in short, is actually really full of a lot of hope, and it has some directives that are a little bit more aimed towards individuals and as well as companies and things that you actually do that you can actually do on kind of an ongoing daily thing. And it's exciting because it's an international document. So these are things that Indigenous peoples are doing all over the world. So you can kind of start to feel as well. And this is where you start to try and find these networks of hope. And that's where I find it in the UNDRIP.
Right.
Yeah, that's great.
Wow.
I feel like we're wrapping up and we should be wrapping up because I know we have to let you go soon, Jackie. Obviously, this is kind of a like let's talk more about this. Like, we're not done. This is not a complete summary of this by any means.
Yeah, this feels like a series if I've ever heard one.
Yeah, but like, I believe in, like, part of what was so sad about this for me is for a long time I really believed in, like, the story of what Canada was, and I believed that Canada was a multicultural nation where all people were welcome and that we believed in pluralism and, you know, you could live your life many different ways and they were all legit. But the truth is we won't actually be that until this justice is found, the justice for the Indigenous people on whose suffering this country was built. Like, it will always be kind of a hollow idea until this justice is found. And I really hope one day that country exists, the country that I thought existed for a very long time. It doesn't right now, but, you know, it's only us that can do it. Like it's only us that can start this process from process happening. And it's the first step for all of us is simply learning what happened. You know, it's about learning these facts and learning how it was put, how it happened, and why it happened. It's important.
I was going to say, like, one of the primary lessons I'm taking from this is, like, I just need to have conversations about this more often, and I think everyone listening to this should also be encouraged to engage in conversations about it, despite how kind of scary it is, I think, to talk about. Especially if you're not either not Aboriginal or don't know much about it, about these issues as I clearly don't. You know, I think and also, you know, and that being said, also keep in mind that a conversation is when you talk to someone and you're willing to have your mind changed, not when you're willing to just, like, put your opinion on the table. This is very, very interesting, and now I feel like I'm going to be up all night thinking about it.
Oh man, just wait. You're going to be in the shower, you're going to get some sad thoughts, man, and then it's going to start.
Joke's
then
on you, really Richard. Every shower I have is full of sad thoughts.
Do kittens cry? A kitten's probably cried. That's the sad thought I just had.
Her cat just sitting right above our computer the whole time, and she actually had her whole head buried.
Do you guys have any wrap-up thoughts, any last parting things you want to just kind of leave with for now?
I think one of the most important things is that there are frameworks that have been in existence for a very long time. There are Indigenous perspectives on how to relate to each other that are sustainable in themselves, and they're very useful idea to tap into every once in a while and apply that in your life. And that utility is something that I feel is extremely important now. And I feel like the discussions that we're having and the awareness that we're having will eventually lead us to a place where we're able to have those relationships with each other as Canadians, as treaty people, as just people, that will go on in a parallel relationship, sharing in abundance until the world breaks and we all return to the undying lands.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I would probably play the Kukum, the grandmother card, and just say a lot of I guess this was me as a Kukum. A lot of literature is showing that resiliency comes from your ability to recharge. So, you know, that fatigue, that feeling of like, oh my God, this is so much work. How am I going to do this? You know, you have to take care of yourself and take care of each other, and you know, remember that this is a this is a long journey that we're on, and we have to, you know, make sure that we're, you know, not in an extreme amount of pain the entire time. So I think that's an important thing.
But and another thing is that, and this is something that Jackie and I always go back to, is it's not just our ancestors looking at us and watching what we're doing, but we also have an endless amount of our future generations that will come after us that are also watching us. And how we move through the world. So that's an important thing to know, that you are connected to both the past and the future, and you play a very important role. Even if you feel like you can't engage in this conversation, you already, by existing, have the capability to do it. You don't need to change anything. It's just a matter of being like, yeah, I can do it.
Great. But as we're on our way out here, I want to make sure that that you guys get an opportunity to plug your podcast that you guys do. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that and where we can find you?
Yeah, so you will find us soon. So we're launching a podcast soon in the winter, when the constellation Wasagichuk, the trickster, the storytellers in the sky. It'll be a seasonal podcast called The Urban Indigenous Survival Guide, where we collide with Indigenous thinkers and allies and leaders and artists as we all work together with these questions that are facing us and affecting us. So keep your ears to the ground and stuff, and we'll have more information about where to find it.
When that comes out, we'll definitely plug it too. Yeah. Like, that's wicked. Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
thanks so much for coming on, you guys. Thanks so much for chatting to us about this. You know, I'm sure if we'd be willing to love to have you on again when this kind of thing comes up and we want to talk more about it, or you know, anything comes up and we want to talk more about it, because you got good brains and we like them.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having us. We had a lot of fun explaining things to Jamie.
Yeah. He's good to explain to, that Jamie. Here's the normal spiel. If you hear anything you want to respond to on these podcasts, if you want to comment on anything, ask us questions, ask us to clarify stuff, disagree with us, whatever, get in touch with us. You can find us on Twitter at ExplainJamie. We're explaintojamie@gmail.com. Just Google ExplainToJamie.
We're on the internet,
up.
Guys.
That's how
You'll
the
find
Google
it.
Works. Yeah.
Yeah. As always, stay vigilant, stay curious, engage in conversations that make you uncomfortable, and keep an open mind. I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
That's Hunter and Jackie. See you later!